Moving to a brighter future or a dark past, Brexit is cooked, and some good news about plastic. Welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am Ben Davison, and with me, as always, is the great, the fantastic, the Bloomberg published... Van Badham. How are you, Van?
I'm fine. You know, this is the highlight of my week. I'm absolutely glad. the highlight of my week.
You know, I get really stressed before we do this.
Yes, yeah. I live with you. I know.
Well, now everybody knows.
Now everybody knows. Everybody should know as well. If we sound slightly distracted, it's because our dog is up to something in the front yard.
He's doing something weird. We don't know what it is.
We don't know what it is. We might have to call for him. You might hear a Germanicus.
Speaking of doing something weird, the... National accounts came out today.
I love how your mind works. Ooh, those weird national accounts. Well, how wacky and unexpected under capitalism.
Well, they were not entirely wacky and unexpected, but they have indicated that the economy has grown. And what's interesting about this, though, is how the economy has grown and where it's grown and where it hasn't. And I know that can kind of sound a bit boring, but people might remember that during the pandemic, there was this moment in time where it seemed like actually we might get a brighter future out of the pandemic.
Yes, that this was the pretext that we needed to walk away from 40 years of miserable neoliberalism and start a bit of wealth redistribution downwards. You know, we increased, of course, welfare support to people, not only those who were trying to hold on to their jobs in the form of JobKeeper, but also the increase to the JobSeeker welfare payment, which, you know, relieved hundreds of thousands of people of a terrible financial burden and gave them breathing space. We also had the opportunity for governments to invest in nationalised industries again. Mm. Maybe, Ben, maybe one of my favourite obsessions, kickstart a bit of domestic manufacturing, you know, with a bit of government capitalisation. Imagine the jobs you could create, Ben. Oh.
And we saw that in some other countries, right? Like we saw Germany invest in Lufthansa to save its aviation industry. We saw even the United States prop up some manufacturing there. We saw Queensland start to produce PPE, you know, like the state government.
We saw
intervened.
A state government in Queensland that, let's face it, was not looking very confident of re-election before the pandemic, stormed to victory on a very simple platform of how about we create some jobs? Let's create some jobs doing things that people need, like expanding public transport, you know, like investing in a bit of clean energy. Imagine.
We saw, of course, during the pandemic, some of those really fundamental drivers of poverty, like homelessness, was starting to be addressed, because it turns out you can put homeless people in hotel rooms and then transition them to social housing if you've got the will to do so. And, of course, the idea that homeless people will be walking around coughing COVID everywhere actually drove governments to act. We saw that childcare was being provided to households for free. And that undercut a huge drop in the cost of living for people. Suddenly it became economically viable for both partners to be working full time if they wanted to be and to participate in the economy.
Not to mention, we also saw the Royal Commission into aged care and the public health findings around the fact that privatised aged care was, you know, COVID vector, whereas there were so comparatively few cases in state-run aged care that we began to think about, oh my God, maybe reforming and renationalising the aged care sector. Oh, the socialist paradise we could have lived in if not for the inconvenient reality of, Ben, what was the inconvenient reality?
The Morrison government.
The Morrison government. But it's all right because he was photographed in his shorts the other day. He's just like us.
And that's where, coming back to where we started, the national account figures today coincided with an OECD forecast about the Australian economy. The OECD forecast happened slightly earlier in the day. Josh Frydenberg was out there saying the OECD predicts a bright future for Australia. What the OECD is expecting is that growth will go up to 3.2% in 2021 and 3.1% in 2022. It's also, however, predicting that unemployment will peak at 7.9%. And it's actually saying that some of the programs that the Morrison government is putting in place are going to be drags on the Australian economy. So all this kind of, oh, the OECD predicts a strong future, which of course was the headline in the Oz. Thank you, Rupert Murdoch. Scott Morrison must be sending him, well, I was going to say a Christmas card, but the reality is he keeps sending him cash from the Commonwealth Treasury. So.
Which he simultaneously takes away from the ABC.
Two birds, one stone, I suppose. So the OECD is saying that there's going to be the unwinding of the financial support, so the unwinding of JobSeeker, the unwinding of JobKeeper, and essentially the cuts to household income are going to reduce spending. They're going to reduce confidence as well. And that's going to create more unemployment, and it's going to have a detrimental impact on the economy. They say that cuts to the social safety net, and that's very broad when you talk about the OECD. In Australia, sometimes we think about the social safety net as all just unemployment benefits, but in OECD terms, social safety net is things like childcare. It is things like support for facilitating people going to work, like childcare. So those things are going to be cut. And it also specifically says the government should be investing in social housing. And of course, we know the Victorian government is. We've talked about that before. But the Commonwealth government continues to hold off on doing that. And it, again, explicitly says that trade will take longer to recover because in other countries, the COVID outbreak is even more severe. And while there's lots of hope around a vaccine for COVID, the reality is widespread rollout won't happen until, at the earliest, the back half of 2021. So other countries are not going to be engaged in trade. Now, the reason why the national accounts, the Australian accounts, are interesting is because they actually reinforce all of that. So our imports are up massively. Our exports are down massively. So even though there's been some economic recovery from the huge economic losses that we took, the 7-point-something% losses that we took at the height of the COVID pandemic, and there's now been a sort of a 3% recovery, the reality is trade is not happening in a way that benefits us. So we're importing luxury cars. We've seen something like a...
Rich people got to drive, Ben.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Rich people got to get new Audi, Ben.
It's called a 48.1%.
I mean, they can't drive around in last year's Audi, Ben. I mean, come on, they're rich people.
You got to love the way these things are classified, right? 48.1% increase in non-industrial transport equipment, which is effectively cars, right? There might be some motorbikes thrown in there, but, you know, we know from new car sales stats domestically that those are not, you know, low-income households buying their first new car.
And let's remember, everybody, we don't make cars in this country anymore,
so
thanks to the Liberals.
Car related is
so
important.
Anything related to cars is from another country.
Also interesting.
I mean, that's not going to cause any long-term problems, is it?
Well, that's the thing. If we made cars here, how much of that would we no longer have to import? And then 18.3%.
But we've got all these trade deals that are just so secure, Ben. We negotiated them all secretly. And, you know, trade deal is for life. It's forever.
An 18.31% increase in textile imports, textile clothing and footwear imports, which, of course, we used to make here and no longer do.
Oh, yes, of course. Haven't we outsourced like 90% or it's more than 80, I believe.
Yeah. And so then you've got the things that we sell to the rest of the world, right? And everybody's, oh, well, iron ore's holding up. That's the dog barking at the neighbours. And people wonder why I couldn't win a local government election.
To be fair, Ben, I think he was worth at least 2 points on your primary.
Yeah, probably. So we've seen declines in mineral ore exports, right? So all this sort of talk about, oh, well, it's okay because iron ore will hold up and we'll sell more coal and all this sort of stuff. Well, nearly 6% decline in mineral ore exports. And, of course, a lot of that is iron ore and coal.
But, Ben, we're going to have a nonsense fuels of the past-led recovery, haven't you heard?
Well, not according to these national accounts, we're not. And this is the thing, right? So this is why I go into this detail and break it down. And I know some people will see it as boring, but actually...
Ben, if they could see the look on your face right now, they'd know just how unboring it is.
It's the makeup of the headline figures that actually determine the kind of policies you need. And what we're seeing really clearly is without domestic production, without local manufacturing, without clear, strong support for local consumption, our economy will taper off. And the OECD is telling us that. These figures on our national accounts are telling that. Because the reality is it's actually been household spending and government spending that's propped up the growth. people are starting to spend again.
Which we have known since the interventions in the economy in the Great Depression. Like, we've always known this.
Yeah.
That the only way to make capitalism work is for massive amounts of socialism to be injected into it. That's the hilarious irony of the whole thing. Like, if you want a capitalist economy to function and you want to have prosperity and expansion and innovation and entrepreneurship and also have a market, a domestic market to sell things to, which means those homeless people and things have got to get homes and families got to get jobs, you actually have to socialise parts of your economy. We've always known that.
And
yet here we are again.
And Morrison is socialising the wrong parts of our economy.
Of course he is.
Because
he's Scott Morrison. He's got things on his mind, Ben, like chicken coops and being just like us.
So
he's so like us, don't you think? He really relates to us.
His fundamental narrative of the pandemic has been the cost of business, right? And business has really suffered. Now, we know that many small businesses have suffered, right? We know that many small businesses in hospitality and accommodation and domestic tourism have suffered, but they're also bouncing back.
But there are also industries that have gone absolutely gangbusters.
And those industries have driven what is called an increase in gross operating surplus for private non-financial corporations.
Whisper that into my ear, Benjamin.
Basically, corporate profits are up 18.2% for the year.
18.2%.
Right, that's the gross operating surplus.
Because the government injected so much money into the economy to keep everything going. Amazing. It's almost there's like some consistent internal logic or something. Oh my God.
So when you think about what has been happening in our economy, and you think about job losses, and you think about wage freezes, and you think about all these things, it's actually working people who are carrying the cost of the economy. Business overall, not every business, but overall, is doing very, very well. Very, very well. And we know this because you read about Gerry Harvey getting bonuses and you read about...
While he was happily taking JobKeeper.
Of course.
He also has recently been asking people to work for him for free.
And you see Solomon Lew shutting stores but having record profits, right?
Because everybody's buying things online.
Because everyone's buying things online. So all of this talk about how we need to change the economy and add more flexibility, in inverted commas, to our IR system.
Flexibility means they can fire you more easily and put you on a 0 hours contract, make sure you don't unionise and ensure that you have no power. By the way, just in case you're wondering, that's what flexibility means.
And it's important.
That's what they mean by labour market flexibility. I love that.
And this comes after a period where we saw, in a 24, 48 hour period, nearly a million Australians have their jobs taken away, right? And remember those queues outside Centrelink? You know, that's flexibility. That's labour market flexibility in action. Some would argue the labour market is perhaps a little too flexible at the moment.
Tiny bit.
Given gross surplus for business, 18.2%. And I'm going to say something else here. For the first time since 1960, the wages share of national income is below 50%. Now you think, oh, well, that's okay, 50% to wages and 50% to business. Well, it doesn't quite work like that. National income doesn't quite work like that. And what we've seen since 1970s, late 1970s, is a steady decline in how much of the national income, that's the wealth of the nation, is going into wages, and a very rapid increase in how much is going into profit, right? So for the first time, working people are getting less than half of what our nation's income is, really, since 1960. That is a startling and terrifying fact, because if you take that and you couple it with all these other numbers and all these other indicators that we've just pulled out from the OECD, from the national accounts, then you start to see that during COVID, we've seen a massive transfer of wealth from working people to the already wealthy. Now, I'm not saying every small business there's some giant conspiracy or something like that. It's an ideological position.
Yeah, well, they believe in trickle-down economics. It's a conversation you and I always have about when we hear particularly American political pundits talk about the economy. And in America, the economy has become synonymous with the stock market.
Yeah.
So they had a record day on the Dow the other day on the stock market index, and they hit 30,000 points. I'm sure we can devote an entire episode to explaining what that means. But it's the largest number of points they've ever hit. So many points. Big points. And, you know, and it's for two reasons. One, because a vaccine is in sight and confidence is picking up around the end of coronavirus, which will enable America to get out of the horrible, deathly hole that it's in. Mm-hmm. But also because Biden is going to be president and, you know, not having a chaotic, mango-coloured lunatic running your country, strangely enough, is good for business confidence. But at the same time, we're seeing those unbelievable scenes of miles and miles and miles of cars queuing up for food parcels in Texas, like the home of the American oil industry. Like, we're hearing these horrific stories about overrun COVID clinics and hospitals that have so many patients that don't know what to do with them, and these towns that COVID is ripping through because these towns don't have plumbing and don't have basic services, and there's no protections around people. And the sense of the economy is really disjointed. When I think of an economy, I think about what's working for you and me and our neighbours and our families. Like, if the economy is going well, it means we've all got an income, we've all got a place to sleep, a roof over our head, the capacity for financial independence, you know, childcare, community support. That's an economy. Somebody made the point today, and it might have been Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or somebody very much like her, which was, if trickle-down economics actually worked, like if business was the mechanism by which you could deliver services to people, which is effectively the argument that government shouldn't deliver services to people, business should, because, you know, we have markets and markets will tell you what they need, and it's what people will pay for is what they value, and this nonsense. And whoever it was said, if that theory actually worked, you wouldn't have billionaires and people on food stamps at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, if the wealth was trickling down, the billionaires would be giving some of it up to lift, you know, pumping it through the economy, which is how trickle-down economics is supposed to work, and creating jobs and opportunities for people.
And there's a really good example right here in Australia happening right now. And there's a debate happening right now in Parliament about the Indue card, right? Which is the classic example where you've got an Australian billionaire, Twiggy Forrest, who's got this...
Who lives in a very recognisable reality living in, you know, like with his name basically looking down over the entire city of Perth, not like that's from some superhero movie that a villain does or anything. It's very normal, Ben, very normal.
But this cashless welfare card, as it's called, right, where his company has created this thing where the Morrison government is essentially going to contract them, and jump in when I get this wrong, because I'm sure I will. I hope I will. I hope some of this is wrong. But it's essentially going to contract them to give people who require financial support a debit card as opposed to cash, and restrict what they can and can't buy using this card.
It's already happening. So in parts of South Australia, Queensland and Western Australia, and oh my God, what a coincidence, just happens to be where high concentrations of Indigenous Australians live, they're trialling the Indue card. So the way that it works, according to the government website, is that it's a debit card. And you use it just like a debit card, and 80% of your welfare payment goes on that, and then 20% goes into your bank account, because, you know, you shouldn't be caught completely without cash. I mean, that would be impractical. In fact, the website says, you know, the government recognises we don't completely live in a cashless society yet. And the website is genuinely hilarious. Mm. Like, it becomes, it not only is it grossly paternalistic, but it becomes very clear nobody involved in thinking this up has ever met a poor person. Like, that's just not a thing that's happened, or a struggling person, or about, like, happy to take votes from them, doesn't really want to think about their lives. So the Indue card is essentially an extension of things we've seen in America, of course, when food in America stamps. They have food stamps, because you can't have poor people making their own economic decisions, because, you know, if you're getting a welfare payment, that said poor person might spend, and I speak for myself, look, I have been on the dole, like I have been in this welfare category. category. Yeah, yeah. Obviously, as have you. Obviously, with some advantages, but obviously with other disadvantages, like living in Wollongong, where unemployment was through the roof with no opportunity and just chronic depression. So the idea is that you don't, it's totally paternalistic because people might spend their money on alcohol or drugs or cigarettes or gambling or the vices, Ben, the terrible, terrible vices of poor people. It's positively Victorian. You know, we have to restrict, you know, we have to restrict their spending to this card so they will only spend on nice things, you know. And it and this is not to say that there aren't huge problems with substance abuse and gambling, all of those addictive behaviours in marginalised and oppressed communities. But we know from considerable amounts of evidence that cutting off people's access to cash with some kind of card doesn't go away. Like, if it worked, they've had food stamps in the United States for decades.
Yeah.
And yet, amazingly enough, there is still drug crime.
Mm.
Imagine. I mean, it's almost as if that particular kind of vice economy exists, and putting people on an Indy card just means to raise cash, they'll find other off-the-books ways of doing that. And I'm sure we can all have a bit of an imagine how that will work. Addiction does not go away if you remove people's income. I'm sorry to inform people. This happens to be a bit of a specialist interest of mine, but that's not how
you fix
addiction.
We should be clear about what happened in the United States as well.
Oh,
right?
My God. Because it's just outrageous. Sorry, everyone.
Well, no, because they have food stamps in the United States. But, of course, the drug economy shifted into the formal economy as well. And we've seen in the last couple of weeks a massive pharmaceutical company get done for pushing opioids onto people.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of Americans, many of them low income, many of them surviving on welfare, overdosed and died.
Yep.
And this was a huge company, multi-billion dollar profits. So, you know, now we're seeing Twiggy Forrest get paid, I read somewhere $10,000 a card, and maybe that's just in the trial period, but they are looking to make this a broader program as well.
They are looking to make this a broader program, and it's terrifying because it doesn't solve any problem apart from making privileged people feel more privileged. So if you are like a wealthy, paternalistic white person, let's be honest, this is an excellent means for you to feel more wealthy, more white, and more paternalistic. Seriously, read the website. It is hilarious. There's this wonderful line about, look, you can do some kind of credit transfers and whatever, just in case you're saving up on welfare, on JobSeeker at its regular rate, not this fancy coronavirus rate, on its regular rate, to save up for electrical appliances or a vehicle or a holiday. And I'm like, yes, that trip to Paris is yours if only you develop a bit of welfare thrift. It's like, what universe do these people live in? Like, how many people do you know on the dole who are able to, oh, I don't know, buy a car? Maybe slap down a cool 50K for a new Mazda. Are you absolutely out of your minds? But there's a quote I want to read you because it is just so absolutely extraordinary.
Given the base rate of welfare payments in this country is so low that you can't afford to rent in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane, I don't think you'll be saving up to buy a car. Give us your quote, Ben.
All right, there's a questions you may have about the cashless debit card. Question 6, I manage my own finances. Why should I be forced to receive the cashless debit card?
That's a good question.
Yes. Answer. The cashless debit card tests whether limiting the available level of welfare cash in a community reduces the harmful effects of welfare-funded alcohol, drug abuse and gambling. People who manage their finances well and do not spend excessive amounts on alcohol, drugs or gambling should not experience any significant difference. Good Lord. So how about let's not actually solve the problem. If you're worried about alcohol abuse, in a community, you build treatment centres, you create jobs, you create forms of social intervention. You know, there's a book I'd really like everyone who listens to this program to read called Chasing the Scream, which is by a friend of mine called Johan Hari. And it's about the fact that the drug war was always destined to fail. And he's actually got a really good video that you might have seen that's worth looking up on YouTube. was a TED talk he did about an experiment called Rat Park, where a scientist had a bunch of rats that were just in a big enclosure. They had an opportunity to drink water or drink water laced with heroin, and they went for the heroin, and all the rats became junkies.
Yeah.
The other half of the experiment was he created this amazing facility he called Rat Park, which had everything fun a rat could possibly do. It had wheels and slides and a pool and all the food that the rats could possibly want, and it still had the tap for water and for heroin.
Yep.
Guess what?
They didn't take heroin.
They didn't take the heroin because they had other things to do. And, like, there's Chasing the Scream just documents all this evidence about the way that we deal with addiction in communities is so wrong. And like I said, the Indie Card has nothing to do with marginalised people or alcohol abuse or gambling. Like, if it's voluntary, and it can be voluntary, you can volunteer to go on Indie, great. All right, if it's voluntary, that's fine. If a person's like, I'm trying to get my life in order, there are temptations I need to cut off, I'm in a recovery program and I'm trying, great, awesome. I'm 100% in favour if it's voluntary.
Like putting cash withdrawal limits on your own ATM card.
But forcing an entire community on, let's face it, racially profiled grounds into that kind of total economic disempowerment is disgraceful. And given the fact that it comes from a framework of you can save up your dollar to go on holiday is just, oh, it just makes me want to vomit in a bucket.
And I think that's a really good case study about whether we're actually moving to a brighter future or whether we're going back to a very dark, very insecure, very paternalistic past. And I think the reality is that as long as the Morrison government is in charge of the recovery, in inverted commas, we're going to see Indie Card, we're going to see the community development program return, we're going to see horrific restrictions on people on JobSeeker, we're going to see more insecurity in our employment, and we're going to see more transfer out of wages into profits. And working people, whether they're in a job, whether they're looking for a job, whether they've retired from a job, suffer in order to prop up profit. And it doesn't have to be like that.
No, it doesn't.
And it's really sad, but, you know, look, at the same time, there'll
people
be an election probably the end of next year.
Yeah, and look, everybody, there are petitions and campaigns online. I shared one on my Twitter the other day to campaign against the Indie Card. And do you know what would be great? If you had a conversation with your Conservative aunt who lives in a safe Liberal seat, or preferably a marginal one, to write a nasty letter going, this is terribly paternalistic. I thought we had outgrown this some time ago. How desperately, desperately disempowering. That would be hugely helpful.
I think that would be great. So
I'm so angry.
No, I know you are. So we want to get rid of the Indie Card. We want to invest in training, education, social housing, more direct financial support.
Rat Park.
We need to
I want to live in Rat Park.
Job security that'll give people the confidence to drive domestic spending. We want universal access to childcare and proper wages for people who work in early childhood education. We want to rebuild domestic manufacturing so that we can make our own way in the world.
And you really know how to get me, don't you?
Not have to deal with all of this
stuff
that's
going on with
China.
That's what he says on Friday nights. He looks to me kindly and says, let's rebuild domestic manufacturing.
And you know what would be really nice? Is if when we get
peace,
older...
Peace, land, bread, what?
When we get older, we don't have to go into a privatised system and be neglected and die in pain and agony, but die with dignity, surrounded by loved ones and people who have proper time to care for us. So let's have that as well.
Supported aged care, state supported aged care.
I think that would be good.
That's almost what you would do if you were a society or a community as opposed to individuated lumps of human investment.
That's our breakdown of the national accounts. It's a bit of a different breakdown. It's different to what you're going to hear from Josh Frydenberg. It's probably different from what you're going to hear from Labor as well in some ways, frankly. But I think it's important that you understand the actual factors that make up national accounts. It's more than numbers. It's real policy. It's real impacts on people.
To be fair, Andrew Leigh had a bit of a golden moment the other day where I think it was Philip Lowe was saying, oh, well, you know, an increase in unemployment would actually be really great for the economy because it puts downward pressure on wages, everybody. The more unemployed people you have, the more people are desperate
not to be
unemployed.
You've already got record low wage growth.
And Andrew Leigh, one of the Labor finance team, took him apart and was like, full employment is better.
Yes.
Full employment is better because Philip Lowe was concerned about, you know, the deficit. You know, and we know that Victoria, because we're spending money to create jobs and rebuild the economy, Victoria will lead the country in the economic recovery from the coronavirus because Andrews is like spending like crazy on jobs because he knows jobs will bring money back into the economy. 500,000 jobs in the next 4 years. I know I'd rather live in Victoria.
And let's be really honest about that too. Queensland has recovered and has now got more jobs than it had at the start of the pandemic. And WA has been growing basically the whole time because they have invested in jobs, because they have said, if people don't thrive, the economy doesn't thrive.
Mm.
Right? It's not about how much you can transfer into profits. That is not how you get a thriving economy and thriving people. Anyway, let's talk about somebody else's dumpster fire of economy, because they're in an even worse state than we are.
I'm just looking forward to the day that Britain and America sort themselves out, so in Australia we work harder, you know what I mean?
We might be in that state-funded aged care by then, Van.
So Britain's a mess, and this is my other home. Yeah. Like, this is the country I lived for 10 years.
Brexit is cooked, right?
Brexit is cooked. Like, they voted to leave the European Union for completely nutty and mostly false reasons 4 years ago.
Quite a bit of racism. Quite a bit of keep the polls out.
Yeah,
right?
Keep the polls out, keep the Romanians out, bit of Johnny Foreigner go home. And everybody said it was about taking back control. About taking back control of the image, an image of Britain, which has never existed. You know, the modern British have this idea of the Second World War as this time when, you know, men were heroes and we all, you know, we did it for ourselves and we fought Jerry and, you know, we just were great. And it's like, do you know why these narratives are so heroic to you? Because everybody was so absolutely broken after the Second World War, they didn't want to talk about the horror, the pain and the deprivation they went through.
Can I also just say that for a bunch of people who believe that about themselves and who see the Second World War as definingly British, who then go on to say we need to send the Poles home, the Poles flew in the Battle of Britain. The Poles helped defeat the Jerry. Yeah. Like, let's be really clear about that.
Yeah, but more than that too, it's like it's a propaganda image of the Second World War as all knees up Mother Brown and, you know, pie and mash shops. And, I mean, it was horrendous. At one point, the German U-boat campaign was so absolutely effective that they were getting fleets of the merchant marine who were bringing food from, because Britain hasn't been able to feed itself on its own domestic produce for hundreds of years, and getting food from Canada and America, and the ships were all being sunk. Britain got reduced to 2 weeks.
Yeah.
2 weeks before their supplies completely collapsed. That's how desperate and crazy it got. And they have literally voted themselves into replicating what the Germans were trying to do to them, which is to be cut off without imports. And withdrawing from the European common market, that means, you know, coordinated import-export relationships with food providers. That's what it means to leave the common market, is to say, no, you keep your food. We've got some medlars. And it's one of the things that I found amazing.
Medlar?
It's one of the few fruits that grow organically in Britain.
Right.
Yeah, and we don't need them. Yeah, there's a reason why.
I've been to Britain and I've never heard of it.
No. Well, because nothing grows there. Like, one of the defining moments for me, like the first week I lived in England, was I went into a supermarket to get English spinach and they all looked at me like I was a crazy person. They were like, what's that? Because I just didn't eat it and didn't grow it and had no access to it. It was just like, you've got to be joking. And there's a reason why the British cuisine is notoriously weak, because they can't grow. There are things that just do not grow there.
Yeah, like most things.
Like most things, and certainly not at scale to feed 60 million people. And, of course, they've argued with the European Union. They've announced they were going to break the law. Oh, we're just going to break some laws around trade deals. They hired Tony freaking Abbott to be their trade envoy. As John Kadilka said, the trade genius is the person who traded Tony Abbott to Britain. Get that person to handle your trade negotiations. And of course, the British have been, under Johnson, sailing along with this idea that Uncle Trump will solve all their problems.
We'll have a free trade deal with America.
Yeah, we'll have a free trade deal with America. Well, Joe Biden has said no, because Joe Biden is an Irish-American, and the Irish are none too pleased with the way that Britain's been carrying on around what they call the backstop, which is the Irish do not want a hard border back between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. That hard border was responsible for terrorism and death and just the worst kind of chaos.
Well, we know that hard borders create sense of otherness and a sense of otherness in that situation is going to create violence.
Yes, yes. And it's completely ridiculous. I have a friend in Northern Ireland and the border, the proposed hard border, goes through her parents' backyard, separating their house from their shed.
I love that council planning, once the Good Friday Accords came in and they got rid of the hard border, we're like, yep, the best thing we can do is actually have people live on the line. If they're on the line, if their properties are on the line, the hard border will never come back. Little did they expect Boris I'm a Clown Johnson to appear.
Oh, well, this is the thing. So the Northern Irish, and let's remember, Northern Ireland voted against Brexit significantly.
Yeah, overwhelmingly.
You know, the Scottish are talking about independence because even though that referendum for independence went down a few years ago, now Britain is careening towards, you know, a U-boat wonderland.
Well, if you got to pick a supranational state, would you pick England with its, what did you call them? Mandolins?
Medlars.
Medlars.
I've got some medlars. Can't get any spinach.
Or would you pick, you know, steak frites from France and wine from Spain and pasta from Italy and pork knuckle from Germany? Because I can tell you which supranationalist state I'd be signing up to. Scotland.
Oh, my Lord. So, yeah, so Scotland, independence is you know,
back
gathering strength, back
yeah.
on the agenda. Both sides of Ireland are furious. Biden has said, I'm not playing this game with you. The prospective American trade deal, which was going to solve all their problems, is gone. Tony Abbott has a job. It's incomprehensible. Well, so it turns out YouGov, which is the polling
company,
they did a survey, and Britain has like less than 4 weeks now.
Yeah.
And if they don't do a deal with the EU, they have no deal.
Yeah.
And they will not know where their next salad is coming from. Literally,
yeah.
That's what's going on. Majority of Britons have decided that maybe Brexit was a bit of a mistake. 51%.
Yeah.
38% are still hanging in there, going, oh, no, it'll all be all right. But 60% of Britons think that whatever you think of Brexit, the government aren't handling it.
Well, I mean, I've got some other numbers here too, right, that kind of compound this. And as you say, 1st of January, the UK is out of the EU. Like, it's on. They've now got new visa laws that they're going to bring in. They're talking about a points-based system, which I have to say has not worked that well for Australia, frankly. But sure, you can have that with your Tony Abbott. That's fine. Good side of racist visa laws. But some of these other numbers, they're saying prices will just go up instantly 1.5% on everything. Everything will just go up 1.5%. You know, so that's on average. You're going to have some stuff that goes up even more. The auto industry in the UK will lose £110 billion. £110 billion. So that's what, 250 million Australian, sorry, 250 billion Australian dollars?
It's a lot.
It's
that's a quarter
money.
Of a trillion Australian dollars.
UK GDP will lose another 2% on top of what they've lost from COVID, up to 6%.
And let's remember, Britain has the highest death rate in Europe. Like, the management of coronavirus has been so bad in Britain that they have had, they're an island?
Yeah. Well, that's another funny thing.
Sorry, a collection of islands. And this is for all of their, take back control, didn't close their borders when they maybe should have. What
well,
do you reckon?
This is the other funny thing, right? So they're saying, oh, but we supply fish to Europe. We've got fishery because we're an island and we can do fishing. They haven't got boats. They haven't got boats. They haven't got fishermen anymore. Like, the fishing industry in the UK, I mean, there's pockets of it, sure, but it's not. Like, they rely on the EU to fish their waters so they can have cod and kipper and all the It's like, no, you're not.
But their shipyards have all gone as well. Those shipyards went to Korea a really long time ago.
All this extra industry that they're going to get from, you know, doing their own fishing, which they're not going to be able to do, there's still going to be an extra 300,000 unemployed, like basically from January, right? So this is no wonder people are starting to go, this is not so good.
51%, 38. In numerical terms, that's what we call a compelling majority. Oh, it might not have been a very good idea. No, you reckon? You reckon maybe listening to Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson was maybe not sensible? Wow, incredible. You've worked that out now. Oh, it is just terrifying. And speaking to friends of mine in Britain, they're like, all hope is gone. Everything is lost. We have a couple of British listeners to this show because they just love the sound of my voice. And I just want to say, we're thinking of you. But make sure, and you always have a home with us, just make sure you quarantine before you get here.
And I think, you know, it's a line that many men of my age will be familiar with, but as Tyler Durden said, after you've lost everything, you're free to do anything. So good luck, Britain.
I never
good
really luck. Saw Britain as, you know, heading towards Mad Max because it's very rainy, but, you know, medlar fight.
Medlar fight. All right, folks, you're going to have to look up what a medlar is. We're going to move to the good news because we are now running at over 40 minutes for this episode.
No way. I know. Having such chats.
What's the good news?
Oh, my God. So a company in the UK, of all places, at Imperial College London, because they still have an education system, which is the great irony, has come up with a chemical additive.
It's a very elitist system, though, clearly. Yep.
Yeah. Look, it is. That British class system thing, when Boris Johnson is considered elite, you've got a problem. Now I'm just like on the British class system. Imperial College London, which is full of some very, very clever people, has come up with an additive, working with a company to put in plastic that naturally biodegrades plastic within a year. And the additive is such that they reckon they can put it in the plastic process now.
Great.
And that it's not going to require massive industrial change. Mm-hmm. They think, they're pretty confident, and based on trials and results and they've been doing the work, that they can add this additive and then whether it's a candy wrapper or a, you know, box of salad, that it'll break down to a waxy sludge within a year.
Waxy sludge.
And as your partner who made you do that plastic-free month that time, you must be thrilled.
Yeah, because pretty much if you try and go plastic-free now, everything ends up as a waxy sludge. So having the plastic be the waxy sludge at the end of the process, as opposed to everything you're trying to store and the things you're trying to use to store things, that would be a much preferable thing. I have to say, I really hope they get the process right, because the process, I mean, we just talked about how loathe capitalism is to expend any extra money on
capitalism,
people.
Not that innovative, as it turns out.
Yeah. So it's good to hear that they are working through that process problem too, because if they can solve that and we can have no more giant Texas-sized
islands
flotillas
of garbage, yeah,
it would be an amazing outcome.
Yeah.
And good news. What great news.
Yeah, that's made my week. You know, I get sad about the world and these positive environmental stories fill me with joy.
I think they fill us all with joy, Van.
Thank you.
So thank you for bringing us that one. So, folks, that is the week on Wednesday.
It is the week on Wednesday.
For this week.
And thank you to all of our beautiful, loyal listeners. Again, we exhort you to promote the show.
That's right.
On your social media channels and go, oh, these people are so terribly nice, because we really are.
We have had some requests to do short versions on the weekend as well. If we get a groundswell around that, we might do a quick recap occasionally. But tell us if you want to hear that.
People have also said they'd be interested in things like interviews.
Yeah, please tell us who you'd like to hear.
Lefty friends. So let us know who you'd like us to hit up.
And we were told that we could try and go a bit longer. Some people said that, you know, you could do a 45-minute episode. So this episode is the longer version. Let us know how you enjoyed it, or if you think we should go back to a shorter version of the week on Wednesday. And share. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Vamp Adam, Week on Wednesday. Check us out on Facebook. You can share us on Facebook for that conservative old aunt. Make sure she gets a copy of this so that she writes to her conservative MP. Love you, Vanny.
I love you too. You're the best.
Bye.
Bye.